I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome back to Radio Times. The internment of 120,000 Japanese Americans, most of them born in the United States during the Second World War, is a stain on this country's history. Our guest Kermit Roosevelt writes about this time period in his new book, his second novel titled Allegiance. It's about a young Philadelphia lawyer named Caswell Harrison who stumbles on a conspiracy while clerking for Supreme Court Justice Hugo Black. It involves the constitutional questions raised by these camps and some criminal activities by a powerful elite. Kermit Roosevelt said he began to write this book in 2007, thinking about Guantanamo Bay and the U.S. response to the September 11th attacks. He's a professor of constitutional law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. He clerked for Supreme Court Justice David Souter. And Kermit Roosevelt, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much. I'm glad to be with you.
Nice to have you with us. And what in 2007 got you thinking not just about this book, but also thinking about Guantanamo Bay?
Well, in 2007, I was actually working on a Guantanamo case. I got a call from a Philadelphia area Army reservist who had been activated as a defense lawyer, and he thought he should have a constitutional law consultant. So he called me up, and I said, yeah, you know, this seems like a very important issue. I want to make sure that we're not bending the Constitution in our desire to get bad people. So I signed on. So I was working on that.
And at the same time thinking, oh, there's some interesting parallels to World War II, or, oh, there's perhaps a novel I can write in here?
Well, the way that came about was the editor for my first novel said to me, I want your second one to be set in the Supreme Court. And I thought that would be difficult to do in the present day because I clerked for Justice Souter. He's a very private person. I didn't want people thinking that I was revealing secrets I'd learned. My editor said, why don't you set it in the future and just make up nine new justices, which seemed impossible to me. But then my wife said, you can set it in the past. And that seemed like a great idea because I could look up the actual historical justices and I could find an era and a set of cases that had some parallels to what was going on now. So I started looking back through the Supreme Court's history and Japanese-American internment jumped out at me.
And you like this idea of mixing fact and fiction because there are a number of very familiar names in this novel.
Oh, yes. For parts of the novel, I tried to stay very, very close to the historical record. So the legal plot line that deals with the detention of the Japanese Americans, the cases in the Supreme Court, that's really very accurate. What I tried to do then was add some fictional devices and a plot line with some things that didn't really happen, but that tried to illustrate the same themes.
And I guess the lead character is this guy named Caswell or Cash Harrison. How would you describe him?
He's an insider. He's supposed to be a Philadelphia blue blood, really. He knows the government's on his side. He really trusts the government. He thinks it's impossible at the beginning for the government to do anything wrong. And what happens as he goes through the book is he starts to become a little bit more skeptical about the government, and also he starts to broaden his understanding of people. He broadens his understanding of who counts as an American.
Is it based on anyone you know? He's a young Philadelphia lawyer.
He's not based
on... Or a composite, maybe?
Well, he's based on quite a lot of research that I did into Philadelphia society at the time. But there's no individual who's a model, really.
I mean, you seem to know the sort of world of the social register in Philadelphia pretty well. That's what your research was about?
Well, I did research on everything in the novel. I read several books about Philadelphia society. I read biographies of the Supreme Court justices. I read stories about the litigation of these cases. And actually, in the legal work that he does, Cash is based on some real Justice Department lawyers.
Oh, interesting.
Because almost everything he does in the book was actually done by some Justice Department lawyer.
Because you have the certain kind of details here, knowing he knows about, is it Northeast Harbor? I mean, that there are places where blue bloods go, you know, for the summer, Northeast Harbor being one of them.
Yes, yes. So I read some of Digby Balzell's books. I read Francis Biddle's autobiography. There's actually a lot of material out there that will help you get the flavor of wartime Philadelphia.
Well, in the beginning, it's the attack on Pearl Harbor, and it's hard not to think of also the attack of September 11th. I mean, just the sort of public shock, horror, outrage about this, what, you know, appeared to be an unprovoked attack on the United States.
Absolutely. That's what the beginning is meant to evoke. And I even tried to write it in a slightly ambiguous way so that for part of the time it could be a description of September 11th. Because that's one of the amazing parallels. You've got this shocking attack. It's on American soil. We felt so safe. We didn't think this could happen. And in our shock, we react in a particular way. And that was what I wanted to explore.
Cash, like a number of young men at the time, you know, wants to sign up, wants to join the military. But he fails the physical exam. He's 4F. And I'm just, as a plot device, I mean, obviously that steers him towards a different kind of service to his country. Was there any question about whether he would pass or fail this physical for you as the writer?
Well, for me as the writer, he had to fail because
it's a good plot device, right?
His character arc is not going into the military. It's going to work at the Supreme Court and then at the Department of Justice. But I liked the idea of him failing the physical because it sets up his basic character dynamic, which is he wants to do the right thing. Right. And he's always trying to find what the right thing is and struggling with that question. And he's continually feeling thwarted because he's not allowed to put himself in danger the way that he really wants to.
And he ends up clerking for Supreme Court Justice Hugo Black. Was there a reason why you picked him?
I picked Black because he's the one who ends up writing the opinion in the Korematsu case, which is about the forced removal from the West Coast of the Japanese Americans. So I wanted Cash to have a close relationship with the author of that case.
I'd love to have you read a section from the book, and this is where Caswell Harrison Cash is playing tennis with Supreme Court Justice Hugo Black.
Sure. Black isn't particularly good, but he's serious about his game. The Senate doctor told me no man in his 40s should play singles, so I waited till I was 50. He tells me cheerfully. I can still beat both my sons. And now that I've switched to an Eastern grip, I think I'm safe for another 5 years. Not from me. Black and I have similar styles. We are both retrievers, cautious, letting the other man make the mistakes. But my shots are better, and I am faster. I win the first set we play, 6-2. Black leans on the net post, gasping. Let's try it again. I think I can beat you. His wife, Josephine, has come and gone, her sky-blue eyes flashing amusement. But their 5-year-old, little Jojo, is still watching from the shade of a peach tree. Go get us some V8, he calls, and she scampers off, blonde and precious. My orange juice is over Hitler's rooftops, Black says, quoting a war information poster. V8's better for you anyway. By the second set, I have learned to anticipate his only dangerous shot, a tricky forehand sliced down the line, spinning so it curves out of the court. I'm serving at 4-1 when he tries it in desperation. I'm there in plenty of time, sliding into position on the red clay, racket accelerating into the stroke, and suddenly I'm on my back, looking up at the sky. I turn my head slightly to the left. The wall I collided with is inches from my face. Sorry, Black calls. He walks around the net, hand raised in apology. Not a lot of space there. You're not used to it. That's okay, I say. I flex my fingers experimentally. Nothing's broken, but I've lost some skin from the knuckles. I think I'll call it a day. No, you won't, says Black. His voice is no longer apologetic. You'll keep going. My hand's a little sore. You think you can quit and it won't matter, Black says. What's a tennis game? Give up and go on. But one day you'll find something where if you don't keep going, you might as well be dead. That's what I'm training you for. I look at the spots of blood on my knee. I wanted to talk about some of the certs, Judge. I rack my brain for a viable case. There are these children who don't want to recite the Pledge of Allegiance. We'll get to that, Black says. Right now, I want to see that backhand.
That's Kermit Roosevelt reading from his novel. It's his second novel, and it's titled Allegiance. So what have we learned about these two people from that tennis game?
Well, that's supposed to tell you something about Black's character, because that really is Black's philosophy, that you have to keep going. Right. And it shows you something about the way in which Cash is learning from Black and the way in which they're getting closer.
It also shows that Hugo Black, he has a sense of humor, but he's also dangerous. I mean, in certain ways, it's, you know, this young player almost collides with this wall that's right next to the tennis court.
Well, Black really believes in toughness. So this is an example of something that's drawn from fact. Black did have a tennis court at his house.
Did he? Oh.
There was a wall that was too close
oh, really?
To the margin of the court.
By design,
people
you think?
Did run into it. No, I think he just didn't have enough space. But people did run into it. And it was a toughening experience.
Are you a tennis player?
I am. So this is also an example of how I mixed historical fact and my own experience. The way that I describe Black's tennis game, I don't know what he actually really played like. That's based on my tennis game with Antonin Scalia.
Oh, you've played tennis with Antonin Scalia?
Yes, when I was clerking, I played with Justice Scalia.
And how's his backhand?
Well, he's got that dangerous sliced forehand. His backhand's not his strength.
And how did you do playing against Scalia?
I won.
Well, you have a big grin on your face. Handily?
No, it was pretty close. He has some unpredictable shots.
Which is perhaps the way he has
yes.
been on the court as well?
Sometimes he goes left when you don't expect it.
This character is a clerk, and he talks about certs. And a lot of his time is taken up early on the court as a clerk for Hugo Black on these certs. You've also clerked for Justice Souter. Is that in a sense what clerks do early on, and what's a cert?
A cert is a petition by someone who's lost in a lower court asking the Supreme Court to hear their case. Not everyone knows this, but the Supreme Court generally doesn't have to hear any case it doesn't want to. So they look through all of these hundreds of thousands of requests for the court's time and attention, and they pick out the ones that they think are important enough. And that is a lot of what the clerks do. The clerks sift through these large, large numbers of petitions, and they make recommendations to the justices about whether a case should be heard or not.
And Cash is interested in this case of young people that don't want to pledge allegiance to the flag.
Yes.
Jehovah's Witnesses, is it?
Jehovah's Witnesses, yeah. This is a case where school children were required in public school to raise their hands. It actually looked sort of like a Nazi salute. It was a stiff-armed salute. To raise their hands to the flag and recite the Pledge of Allegiance. Some Jehovah's Witnesses children refused to do that, and they were expelled.
And your book is called Allegiance. I mean, it looks at allegiance. Certainly, I mean, during a wartime, this question of allegiance takes on such power and importance.
Yes, allegiance is really a central concept for this book. And in wartime, you've got a question, you know, is your allegiance to your country or the enemy? And that's the easy one. But then the question is, what does it mean to be loyal, to bear allegiance to your country? What do you do if you have conflicting duties? What do you do if there are conflicting ideals? What do you do if you think your government is making a mistake? It's doing something wrong. And I try to explore all of those ideas in the book.
And we're almost having a break here. But and again, I don't want to give too much of the story away, but there is a kind of conspiracy within the court. Yes?
There is. Yeah. Without giving too much away, I will say there are actually a couple of different conspiracies.
Fun to write about or imagine?
Oh, a lot of fun. A lot of fun.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Kermit Roosevelt. He's our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's a professor of constitutional law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. He's now written his second novel. It's a new one called Allegiance, and that's what we're talking about in this hour of Radio Times. It is set during World War II, and it involves the internment of 120,000 Japanese Americans. Of course, this truly happened. Most of them born in the United States, raising a whole host of questions about things like allegiance and the Constitution. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. And if you want to join us, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking about fiction and also some people who have played an important role in our legal system, Supreme Court justices. And our guest is Kermit Roosevelt, professor of constitutional law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, author of a novel, a new book called Allegiance. And again, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Well, let's go back to some of the actual history. And I think for hopefully most people know this, but about 120,000 Japanese Americans, most of them were American citizens, were interned during the Second World War, I guess seen as what, enemy combatants living within our own borders?
Well, they weren't quite enemy combatants. So even the people who were in favor of this evacuation and detention program, even the government lawyers defending it in court said most of these people are loyal Americans. The problem is some of them might not be, and we can't tell who's loyal and who's not. So we have to make them all leave. That's the reasonable thing to do.
And people were rounded up and camps created in different parts of the country.
Yes. And these were, you know, these were very Spartan camps with guard towers, searchlights, machine guns, barbed wire. everything you would expect in a really a detention prison camp.
And I mean, a number of people obviously had to sign off on this, including the President of the United States. But what was behind this? What was the thinking behind this?
If you look at it, there were a couple of different factors that came together, I think. So one was there were groups of people who sort of really just had it in for the Japanese and Japanese Americans living on the West Coast. There were racist groups. There was one called the Native Sons of the Golden West, and they wanted to make the West Coast white again. And then there were economic interests. So there were fruit growers, there were farmers who didn't like the economic competition from the Japanese American farms and who thought maybe, you know, if we can get rid of these people, we can take their farmland. So there's racism, there's economic opportunism, and there was also, inspired by racism, but sincere concern. So it's mistaken, but some people in the army did really believe this population presents a security threat. So you put all of that together, there's a pretty strong push to get rid of the Japanese American population on the West Coast, and there's really no one who cares enough about them and is in a position of power sufficient to stop it.
You have a photograph in the middle of the book of a woman, or several women, I guess, standing in front of trucks. Looks like trucks sort of laden with, what, suitcases or some of their possessions. Where did this photo come from?
This is a government photo. So one of the amazing things about the Japanese-American detention is it was documented by the government, by some incredible photographers, actually. Dorothea Lange, Ansel Adams, took these government photos, and because they're government photos, they're in the public domain.
Yeah.
So we were able to go through a lot of these online, pick out some ones that we thought were especially telling, and put them in the book.
And what's going on in this picture here?
This is a line of army trucks, and this, you know, this happened all up and down the West Coast. It's a line of army trucks packed with some belongings and with some people. You can actually see people looking out of the back. There's a little girl looking out of the back of that truck.
Yep.
And they're driving off to the camps.
And who was Korematsu?
Fred Korematsu was a guy. He lived in Oakland. He had a girlfriend. Interestingly, she was Italian-American, but not Japanese-American. So he was required to leave. She was not required to leave. He wanted to stay in Oakland with her. And so he refused to report to the assembly center where he was going to be sent off to a camp.
Because he was in love? Or they had a relationship?
He did it for love, yeah.
So, but how did his case become the case that was argued before the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, what happened was he tried to avoid the requirement to leave the West Coast. He actually changed his draft card. He had facial surgery. He told people he was a Mexican from Hawaii. But that didn't work. He was arrested. In the civil system, actually, the judge said, I don't think you're a threat. I'm just going to release you back to Oakland. And then the military police came in and took him from the courtroom at gunpoint, sent him to this assembly center anyway. And then the ACLU and the Japanese American Citizens League and some of the organizations that were opposed to this whole program became interested in his case and thought maybe this is a good vehicle to challenge these exclusion orders.
And what happened?
Well, what happened ultimately was, not to give too much of the plot away, but he lost. The Supreme Court said it's okay. It's okay to make these people leave their homes, 24 hours notice, take only what you can carry, and send them away. The Supreme Court did not say it's okay to detain them in camps. This is an interesting feature about the Supreme Court litigation that most people don't know. It's actually not taught this way in a lot of our history courses.
So they could go live somewhere else? They could, if not in a camp, where would they live?
Well, they probably wouldn't have any place to go. You know, that's why we ended up with the camps, which were not part of the initial plan. The initial plan was just to make the population move. Then it turned out that the states in the interior of the country wouldn't accept them. There was danger of violence. There was no place they would go. So the camps were built, and then they were actually detained in the camps, although sometimes people would be let out on work furloughs to harvest sugar beets in the summer or something like that. But the Supreme Court, in the end, when it had to confront the issue of detention, said, if you can't show a reason to suspect this particular individual of disloyalty, then you cannot make them stay in a camp.
Do you see parallels to Guantanamo? I mean, I can see not parallels to Guantanamo, but do you see some parallels there?
I do see some parallels just in terms of our general reaction, which is we're afraid there are some people we think are dangerous.
And we don't know who they are specifically, right?
Right. We don't know who they are. They're not like us. We don't care very much about their welfare. we're just going to put them away where we think that they can't hurt us. Because Guantanamo, the reason it's different is they're not American citizens and they're all supposed to be bad people, which was not the case with the Japanese Americans. But it turns out it's a little bit more similar than you would like, because we got a lot of people in Guantanamo because of mistaken identity. We got people in Guantanamo because they were turned over to us for bounties. So we did, in fact, have a whole bunch of totally innocent people there. Now, we released a lot of them, but that was in part because the courts got involved and forced the government to do it. And if that hadn't happened, I think you would have had a similar situation where these people are not like us, they're not Americans, we don't really care what happens to them. Maybe we're safer if we keep them in camps. Let's just do it.
Let me reintroduce you. And our guest on Radio Times today is Kermit Roosevelt. And he is, if that name is familiar, the great, great, great grandson of Theodore Roosevelt. Too many greats?
Two greats.
Two greats. Great, great, great grandson of Theodore Roosevelt. He's also a constitutional law professor at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. And he's a novelist. His new book is called Allegiance, and that's what we are talking about on Radio Times. And again, you can join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. There are all sorts of, you know, loyalty questions and I guess loyalty oaths. Even some of these Japanese Americans, and this is part of the story, are asked to what, sign up or sign up for the selective service, even though they're being held in detention camps.
Yes. So the government, over and over again, it tried to sort the loyal from the disloyal. And, you know, initially they said, oh, we just can't do this, so we're going to have to send everyone to these camps. But one of the things that they tried to do later was to figure out who was loyal and who wasn't so that they could segregate out the disloyal. So they sent out a questionnaire which asked people a couple of things. And one of them was, will you forswear loyalty to the Emperor of Japan and pledge allegiance to the United States? And another one was, are you willing to serve in the U.S. military? This turned out not to work very well
right.
for a number of reasons.
And can you explain the reasons?
Well, one reason was people thought it was a trick question, this first question, will you forswear loyalty to right. the Emperor? Because it seemed that if you said yes, you were admitting that you had been loyal to the Emperor. Another thing was that a lot of the people they were asking this question of were Japanese. They were not Americans. They were not allowed to become Americans. We didn't let Japanese immigrants acquire American citizenship. So the people who hadn't been born here were being asked to forswear loyalty to their own country and pledge allegiance to the United States, which was at war with their country. So they were being asked to commit treason.
And this is – from your research, you found these questionnaires? I mean, it was this, these are documents that you can
– Oh, yes. It's online. This is all real. Yeah. So what happened was a lot of people said no to these questions. And if the parents said no, frequently the children would say no because they didn't want to be separated. And so you ended up with thousands of people who were now judged disloyal because they had said no to these questions. Mm-hmm. They got sent out to a special camp in Tula Lake, California. And this was a population where now we thought they were all disloyal, but in fact, again, most of them were not.
And they were largely American citizens, too.
Yes. The overwhelming majority of this group is birthright American citizens.
Which is interesting, and I say that because, as we know, this is an issue certainly that's come up on the Republican presidential campaign trail, raising questions about something that's enshrined, what, in the 14th Amendment about birthright citizenship. So here we are doing a version of what you're writing about in this novel that actually happened during the Second World War.
Yes. Well, you know, this is something that happens a lot, I think, because our Constitution, it didn't initially tell us who was a U.S. citizen. After the Civil War, it does. It says all persons born here and subject to the jurisdiction of the United States are U.S. citizens. But I think that that doesn't satisfy some people because we've got a sense of who's a real American and who's not. Mm. And birthright citizenship doesn't match up with what some people think is the right test for who's a real American. And so they're looking for a way to get around that. They're looking for a way to limit citizenship to the people that they believe are the real Americans.
And from your perspective, what do you think their description of a real American is then?
Well, it depends on who you're asking. But I think, you know, they are suspicious of people who don't look like them, who don't share their religion. They think that America has a particular look and a particular set of values. And they're suspicious of people that they don't think share those values.
I'm just reading here from the 14th Amendment. All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. Just to underscore what you were saying earlier. In this novel, a number of Frankfurter and some other judges and justices get involved. And do they play in your novel the role that they played in real life in terms of where they stood on the detention of Japanese Americans?
Yes. So insofar as we're talking about real cases that the Supreme Court decided, everyone on the Supreme Court behaves exactly the way they did in real life. There's also this conspiracy plot, of course. Some of the justices get involved in that to a greater or lesser extent. Frankfurter is one of them. And there I was just making things up.
And was he just a fun justice to be part of the subplot, if I can put it that way?
Frankfurter was fun because he's kind of a colorful character in that, you know, he really rubbed people the wrong way on the Supreme Court. So there are a lot of interesting incidents where people get angry at him and he tries to influence them and he says things about them. If you go through the biographies, in one sense, he's a restrained judge. He doesn't believe that the Supreme Court should be reaching out and deciding social questions and so on. But he's also very much of a schemer, and he has contacts with the government that a sitting justice really shouldn't have, and he's really trying to pull strings behind the scenes.
Let me get some callers in, and we have actually Jan Ting joining us on Radio Times. He's a law professor at Temple University Law School. He's also a blogger for WHYY's Newsworks. And Jan Ting, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Go ahead.
Hey, Marty and Kermit. I've known Kermit over the years, and it sounds like he's written a great book here full of valuable historical insight. And I just wanted to ask him, I thought his explanation of the exclusion order was very good. And I wanted to ask whether he agreed. I've often thought that the term internment was the wrong term to describe the Japanese American experience. It really was, as he said, an order of exclusion. You know, you have to get out of your homes, which is outrageous, but not as outrageous as saying, and you've got to be detained. And in reality, a number of Japanese Americans were able to, evacuate and not be detained, either because they had a place to go or college students were able to go to college in other parts of the country. That's one question on the internment. And the last question is it significant that on the same day Korematsu decision was issued, there was also the unanimous decision in Ex Parte Endo, which said, and you can't detain American citizens, as Kermit said, without a good reason for doing so. So two questions.
Two good ones. Jan Ting, thanks very much for calling into Radio Times. Go ahead, Kermit.
Yeah, those are great questions. And actually, I think it's three questions, really. So the first question about internment, I think that has two parts. One is, was it actually the case that the Japanese Americans were required to be confined in camps? And the answer to that is not entirely. So there was a period when actually if they left the West Coast and could settle somewhere else, they would then be okay. After a certain period in time, they were no longer allowed to leave, though. So the only way out from the West Coast would be to go to these camps. Second question is maybe, is internment the right word? And actually, it's not. So internment during the Second World War, there were internment camps, and those were for enemy aliens. So Japanese citizens, Italian citizens, German citizens, those people could be interned. What was done to U.S. citizens is probably not properly called internment.
What do we call it,
then? Something.
What is the word?
Well,
they couldn't leave, or they could only leave under certain circumstances, right?
Yeah, detention is probably a better word. Concentration camp was a term that some people used actually during the time.
Does that work?
Well, that's since become associated with the idea of a death camp or a liquidation camp, which these certainly were not. So there's some question over what the proper terminology is for this. Japanese American organizations, I think, are opposed to internment, because internment is typically something that you do to non-U.S. citizens.
Oh, interesting.
So I think that generally they prefer detention camp.
Oh, interesting.
Yes.
A number of characters in this book, Francis Biddle, he's the attorney general under FDR, also a Philadelphia lawyer, right?
Yeah. One of the amazing things as I went through this was how many Philadelphia connections there were. And that was something that I was trying to play up, because one of the themes was Cash's development from someone who has a very strong focus on Philadelphia to someone who has a more universal ethical perspective. But it also just seems to be true that, that Philadelphians played a prominent role.
And he was the Attorney General under FDR, right?
He was.
Francis Biddle.
Yes, he was.
Also, Owen Roberts was a Supreme Court justice, I guess, at the time as well. Was he also a Philadelphian?
He was. Yes, he lived just outside the city.
And he opposed Korematsu, yes?
He opposed the detention. Yeah, the interesting thing about Owen Roberts is at the point that Korematsu was decided, he's the only justice not appointed by Roosevelt. And he's really a holdover from the old court which opposed the New Deal. And for a while, he was one of the justices who was pushing back against Roosevelt's attempt to expand the power of the federal government.
Oh,
he did ultimately change his mind, but he retained this belief in individual liberty. And you can sort of see that in his opposition to the detention.
And we're almost up in a break here. But as you make very clear in this novel, and it's certainly true in history, that in times of war, there are questions about just how much authority do you give the commander-in-chief? How much authority does the president have under circumstances of war?
That's a very important question. It's something that constitutional scholars still argue over. And, of course, in the aftermath of September 11th, we had several Supreme Court cases about it.
Let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Kermit Roosevelt. He's a professor of constitutional law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. And as I said, has a new novel. It's his second. It's called Allegiance. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. His first novel, I should add, is In the Shadow of the Law. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Also, it looks like we've got calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Kermit Roosevelt, the great-great-grandson of President Theodore Roosevelt, also professor of constitutional law at the University of Pennsylvania, and he writes novels. His second one has been published. It's called Allegiance. It's set during the Second World War, involves a young Philadelphia lawyer who discovers a conspiracy at the highest levels of government, and our guest, Kermit Roosevelt, mixes fact and fiction to tell this story. And we are talking about some of the fiction and some of the history involved in this book, Allegiance. And it looks like we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. A comment from Diane who says, can you talk about the No-No Boys? Does he bring them up in the book? They're the ones who had to fill out forms who asked if they were loyal to the U.S. or the Japanese emperor, and they checked both as no, no. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so this goes back to the loyalty questionnaire that we were talking about, and it had two questions, numbers 19 and 20. 19 said, will you forswear loyalty to the Emperor of Japan and pledge allegiance to the United States? And 20 said, are you willing to serve in the armed forces of the United States? And for various reasons, some people said no. If you answered no to both of these, you were a no-no.
Right.
And that was enough to get you classified as disloyal. So those people were then sent to Tula Lake, which was supposed to be a concentration center for the disloyal among the Japanese-American population. This gave rise to some of the most interesting episodes, I thought, and some which are in this book, which is then the government began drafting Japanese-American men from these camps. And in fact, they sent draft notices to Tula Lake, where these people had already said they were not willing to serve and were for that reason considered disloyal. So now they're drafting people that they've said are disloyal.
Some was of these that just people, a glitch or well, what?
That's the amazing thing. So some of these people accepted and, you know, some went on to serve with great distinction and great bravery. Some of them said no. Some of them resisted the draft and were prosecuted for it. And most of those people were actually convicted and sentenced to jail. In one case, which I do discuss in this book, some of them were acquitted. And the question the government faced was, well, what are we going to do now?
Right.
Do we appeal this?
Right.
And it turned out that actually draft notices were not supposed to go to Tula Lake. It was just a mistake. It was actually an administrative glitch, as you said. But the War Department nonetheless wanted to prosecute people for saying no to this mistake.
So went after them sort of in spite of themselves in a way.
Yes. Yeah. They sent out the draft notices by mistake, but then they prosecuted people who said no.
There's a character in here. I scribbled on it and where someone says, "Look, I didn't put anyone on a train. I wrote memos." And I wasn't sure who you were thinking of when you wrote that. But, I mean, it does raise questions about if you're a lawyer, if you're writing memos, you know, what responsibility do you have for how they are implemented?
Well, I was definitely thinking about.
Who were you thinking? I mean, you have this grin on your face, so I.
Well, the person who says that is a guy named Carl Ben Detson, who in the aftermath of Pearl Harbor stays awake for days writing memos about the authority of the government to respond, and in fact quite quickly comes up with this plan of removing the Japanese-American population. And I saw an obvious parallel there to the aftermath of September 11th, when people in the Office of Legal Counsel stayed up for days writing memos about what the government could do in response and quite quickly came up with the idea of Guantanamo detention and certain opinions about permissible interrogation techniques, which the government later repudiated. So Carl Ben Detson is supposed to be like one of those memo writers.
Like John Yoo? I mean, he's perhaps the most sort of well-known of that group?
Yes.
I mean, without saying that
so without,
specifically.
Right, without
him.
Saying too much about that, I have interviewed John Yoo. I've seen him on TV. And the way in which I describe Ben Detson's demeanor is intended to bring that to mind a little bit.
Interesting. Well, he was a guest on this show years ago as well. Let me get John from Rosemont to join our conversation. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you, Martin. Love your show. Appreciate you taking the call.
Sure, no problem.
I have a question for your guest. When I went to law school at Temple and took constitutional law, my professor went at length to explain that the Korematsu case, that the justices were not told all the accurate facts, and that the actual decision may have been different if they had been, and that it really did impact on the decision. Can your guest speak to that?
John, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Kermit, go ahead.
Yes, absolutely. That's a great question, and it brings up something that does play a large role in the book, which is, yes, the United States government was not completely honest with the Supreme Court during the Korematsu litigation in particular. So the general in charge of the West Coast, a guy named John DeWitt, prepared a report which justified the need for evacuation on the basis of various factors, some of which were factual assertions about what had been going on the West Coast, assertions about radio transmissions and shore-to-ship signaling, which suggested disloyal activity. And other government agencies, notably the FBI and the FCC, looked into these claims and found that they were false. They were simply mistakes or deliberate errors, who knows, but they were false. Hmm. Nonetheless, the government relied on those facts before the Supreme Court. So there was a big fight in the government about how to handle this, these conflicting reports. But in the end, they presented it to the Supreme Court. They let the Supreme Court believe that this was true. Would the case have come out differently? That's harder to say. Not everyone agrees on whether the justices were misled or whether they were sort of willingly misled. But it certainly could have made a difference. Korematsu is a pretty close case. It's 6-3. It starts out after conference 5-4, in fact. So it's certainly not impossible that greater candor from the U.S. government could have produced a different result.
It's interesting you wrote a novel because it seems like what really was happening at this time is a gripping story. And you've sort of built some interesting fictional characters around all of this and a plot line as well.
Well, it is an incredibly gripping story. And if you're interested in the Supreme Court and law, you can read the history and it's almost as good as a novel. There's a book by Peter Irons called Justice at War, which tells a lot of the story of the internal struggle in the government. And I thought it was an amazing read. There are people, I think, who don't get quite as immersed in the minutiae and the intricacies of the government maneuverings. So what I was trying to do was set the story out here because I think there's a lot of valuable information that people should know, and that's the factual part of the book.
Sure.
But also I was trying to give a dramatic presentation of similar themes, and that's the fictional part of the book. So where you've got this conspiracy and the murder and all of the mystery, it's trying to raise the same questions. How do you know who you can trust? What does it mean to be an American? What are our deepest values?
And your protagonist, Cash, is told at some point, Kermit Roosevelt is dead. And that's your name for your great-grandfather, right?
Yes.
The son of Teddy Roosevelt.
And that is, in fact, a reference to my great-grandfather.
Who did die during the Second World War.
Who did die, yes, on the day that I have it occurring in the book.
I looked him up. He killed himself. Sounds like he battled things like alcoholism and other turmoils, inner turmoil.
Yeah, he had demons. And while his father was alive, he was able to escape those. And while he was healthy enough to engage in rigorous physical activity, he really wanted to fight, actually, to serve in the army. While he was able to face danger, it was enough to keep him going. But he did eventually ruin his health with alcoholism. Mm. He wasn't allowed to serve. He was posted off in Alaska in this remote outpost where there was nothing for him to do. And, yeah, he ended up killing himself.
I mean, it sounds like he enjoyed the outdoors like his father, outdoorsman.
Yeah, he was very much like his father in some way in that they both sought refuge from this darkness in danger. But, you know, Teddy was able to keep it going, and Kermit really couldn't in the end.
Do you have some of that yourself?
I don't think
just
so.
Just a wicked tennis game, but...
Wicked squash game.
Oh,
I'm more of a squash
game.
Player. Yeah. I don't think that I crave danger in the same way.
Let me see what Anne from Chestnut Hill has to say. And excuse me, Anne, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for taking my call, and
you're welcome.
Really look forward to reading your book. My question is really more about government transparency and sort of the truth-telling to the American people about what it really was like and the use of the word internment camp versus concentration camp. I had the experience of being in Cody, Wyoming, and looking at a patriotic artwork that the internees had made when they were based at a camp. They come from Seattle, not far from there. So I asked the security guard, is that camp near here? And he sort of whispered in my ear, and it really was a whisper, and he gave me directions. And he said, if you go down this road is about 30 miles from there. And I took my children, and we found it. It was extremely out of the way, but pretty much intact as it had been left and looking very much like a concentration camp. So my question to you is, in your research, did you go to any camps like that? And how do you feel about making a camp like that open to the public so the American people can see firsthand, just like the camps in, the camps overseas, make it available as a teaching tool?
And I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Kermit, what do you think?
I think that making the camps available is a great idea, and I think that preserving them is important. And this is one of the things that people are struggling with now because the camps haven't been maintained. Many of them really don't have the buildings anymore. So I think that's an important thing to think about. I didn't actually visit any of them. I did a lot of my research online. Like I said, there are very extensive government photo documentation of the whole program. So I generally relied on photos, contemporaneous photos.
What was the case that you got involved in involving a detainee at Guantanamo Bay? It was a guy named Zahir.
Yeah, I was retained, like I said, as a constitutional law expert. What happened, it's sort of an interesting parallel to something that happens in the book, is the Bush administration decided to activate tax lawyers to defend Guantanamo detainees because they thought, I assume, that tax lawyers would not be good at courtroom defense. So I was
by design.
Yes, it was part of the plan. FDR actually did the same thing in World War II with some Nazi saboteurs. So I was asked to serve as a constitutional law consultant for someone who was supposed to be charged before a military tribunal. What happened in the end, though, was the government, they said they were going to charge him, then they said they wouldn't, then they said they would, then they said they wouldn't, and now he's actually just on the list of people who are considered too dangerous to release but will not be charged.
Oh, really?
Yes.
What has he been charged with, or what was he accused of, or were you even able to get that information?
I was able to see the classified evidence against him. It was somewhat underwhelming. So, you know, one thing that happens routinely in situations like this is the government will say to you, these are all bad people, trust us. If you saw the classified evidence, you would agree. And then
the worst of the worst, we were told.
Yes.
Early on.
And then whenever the court says, show us your evidence, explain why you're detaining these people, the government simply said, forget it, we're going to let him go. Right? They did that in a bunch of cases. They didn't, of course, with my guy, but when I saw the classified evidence, I was similarly unimpressed. The allegation against him was he was in a car when someone else threw a grenade at foreigners in Afghanistan.
That's the extent of the case against him.
Yes.
And he's still detained in Guantanamo and considered too dangerous to be released?
Yes. My suspicion is that in part he's considered too dangerous to be released because of things he might say about what happened to him while he was there.
Did you ever go to Guantanamo?
I did, yes. I visited him there.
And did it seem like a concentration camp to you?
Well, yeah. You know, it's a military detention camp. So on the one hand, you sort of expect that, right? And if that were a place where we, after adequate process, detained people who were truly bad people, I would say, of course. You know, of course you've got barbed wire, guard towers, machine guns. These are bad people. When it's a place where people sort of get kidnapped off the street in Albania and taken here and it turns out we just have the wrong name, then it's a little bit more disturbing to see all of the guards and the American flags everywhere and the honor bound to defend freedom motto, which was the actual motto of JTF Gitmo.
Do you think we'll ever close that? I mean, that was the first thing that President Obama said he was going to do when he first got elected president of the United States.
Well, at some point, everyone there will die. And, you know, at that point, we'll close it. But I don't know if it's going to happen before then.
You think they'll stay there for the rest of their lives, however long that is?
I think some of them quite likely will.
Let me get Victor from Center City, Philadelphia, to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Victor. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, I look forward to getting the book of Professor Roosevelt. I'm wondering if you had a chance to speak with the late senator from Hawaii, Daniel Inouye, who was a Japanese Hawaiian. Some years ago, I attended a political function. He was a keynote speaker, and he made strong reference with great intensity to the internment, which he was interned, was not allowed to enlist at first attempt. Eventually, he did get in the military and served in World War II, lost his arm in World War II, and if you did not get a chance to talk with mm-hmm. him, someone that knows his story quite well is a big figure that he sponsored and mentored, and that was the secretary of the VA, Eric Shinseki, and who was also the Army Chief of Staff. I wonder if you had a chance to include Daniel Inouye in your book there.
Victor, thanks for the call. Go ahead, Kermit.
Unfortunately, I never had the chance to talk to Inouye. I do have a bit about the military service of the Japanese Americans. The living real world figure whose story I guess I come closest to putting in is actually George Takei of Star Trek fame, who as a child was in Tula Lake with his family.
Well, on that note, Kermit Roosevelt, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. And he teaches constitutional law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, where he's a professor. And as I said earlier in the hour, have been saying during the hour, his second novel has been published and it's called Allegiance. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times and you can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for the newsletter, listen to us on satellite radio. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. Thanks for those phone calls and thanks for joining us. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen.